This evening I should like to spend some time with you thinking of the love of a believer for his Lord. Shall we turn to Joshua chapter 14, verse 6. When the children of Judah came unto Joshua in Gilgal, Caleb the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said unto him, Thou knowest the thing that the Lord said unto Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee in Kadesh Barnea. 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land, and I brought him word again as it was in mine heart. Nevertheless, my brethren that went up with me made the heart of the people melt, but I wholly followed the Lord my God. And Moses sware on that day, saying, Surely, the land whereon thy feet have trodden shall be thine inheritance, and thy children's forever, because thou hast wholly followed the Lord my God. And now behold, the Lord hath kept me alive, as he said, these 45 years, even since the Lord spake this word unto Moses, while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. And now, lo, I am this day 85 years old. As yet, I am as strong this day as I was the day that Moses sent me, as my strength was then. Even so is my strength now for war, both to go out and to come in. Now, therefore, give me this mountain, whereof thou hearest in that day, whereof the Lord spake in that day. For thou hearest in that day how the Anakim were there, that the cities were great and fenced. If so be the Lord will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. And Joshua blessed him, and gave unto Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, Hebron for an inheritance. Hebron therefore became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, unto this day, because that he wholly followed the Lord God of Israel. The name of Hebron before was Kirjath Arba, which Arba was a great man among the Anakim, and the land had rest from war. You know, the Jews divided old age into three stages. From 60 to 70 was what they called the commencement of old age. From 70 to 80 was what they called hoary-headed age. Over 80, a man was said to be well stricken in years. Caleb, by any standard, was an old man. He was 85 years of age. When John Quincy Adams was a very old man, somebody asked him how he was. Thank you, he said. John Quincy Adams is very well himself, sir. But the house in which he lives is falling to pieces. Time and seasons have nearly destroyed it. The roof is well worn. The walls shattered. It trembles with every gale. I think John Quincy Adams will soon have to move out. But he himself is very well, sir. You know, Caleb did better than that. No, he said, I'm 85 years of age today. And yet I am as strong this day as I was in the day that Moses sent me. As my strength was then, even so is my strength now for war. He had arrived at what we would call the weaker years of life. He was well stricken in years. And yet he was as full of drive and dynamic, and he was still going on for God, well on into old age. What was the secret of the tremendous drive of what should have been the weaker years of life? I think the answer is to be found in the total dedication that marked the working years of life. And what was the secret of the total dedication that marked the working years of Caleb's life? I believe it was in the true dedication that marked the waking years of Caleb's life. As Caleb, at the age of 85, looked back over his life, he could stand before his commander-in-chief and say, I have wholly followed the Lord. You know, the two longest rivers on earth are the Nile and the Amazon. The Blue Nile rises in the mountains of Ethiopia. It thunders down mighty gorges until it joins the White Nile at Khartoum. And there it pushes aside the parent stream and hurries on its way through the desert sands toward the sea. But slowly, the Nile loses all its zeal. It spills over its banks. It spreads itself out all over the delta, and finally it falls exhausted into the Mediterranean. But not so the Amazon. The Amazon is born as a tiny trickle high up in the snow-swept Andes of Peru, just 3 miles above sea level and just 70 miles from the Pacific Ocean. It tumbles down the mountainside and it's joined by other brooks and streams and creeks until presently it becomes a full-fledged river. It churns down through the mountain passes and then with explosive force it bursts into the green wall of the jungle below. Now it has become a mighty inland sea, draining half a continent. Its banks in places 60 miles apart. And finally it reaches the end of its journey. It comes to the sea. And like the River Nile, the Amazon at its mouth is a delta. But at the end of its journey, the Amazon is in its prime. And it forces its way out into the mighty ocean. Its natural force is not abated. And so great is its power and its force at the end of the journey that it refuses to die. And it floods the Atlantic Ocean with fresh water 100 miles offshore. That was Caleb. 85 years of age. He had arrived at by what every standard would say was the weaker years of life. But he could say, I am as strong this day to fight for God as I was in the day when Moses sent me. The tremendous drive that characterized the weaker years of Caleb's life. Oh, it's a great thing, isn't it, to finish like that? Nowadays, we retire a man at 65 and turn him out to run the seed. And yet, you know, at 65, a man has barely begun to realize his full potential. Some years ago, the Daily Mail, one of England's largest daily newspapers, ran a survey of old people. It did a study of some 400 men, statesmen, painters, warriors, poets, authors, men of renown in many fields, and it came to the conclusion that the greatest works of these men were produced when they should have been put on the shelf as unproductive. And the paper came to the conclusion that 64% of all the great things of the world were accomplished by men over 60. That's worth remembering in a day and age that places all the emphasis on youth. Years ago, the poet Longfellow wrote a poem to celebrate old age. It is too late, he wrote. Ah, nothing is too late, till the tired heart shall cease to palpitate. Cato learned Greek at 80. And Sophocles wrote his grand Oedipus, and Simonides bore off the prize of verse from his compeers when each had numbered more than 80 years. and Theophrastus at fourscore years and ten had but begun his Characters of Men, and Chaucer at Woodstock with the Nightingales at 60 wrote the Canterbury Tales, and Goethe at Weimar toiling to the last completed Faust when 80 years were past. Caleb says I'm 85 years of age and I haven't started a fight yet. What a grand old man. The Apostle Paul, you know, had a constant fear of dying on one of God's rubbish heaps as a wicked old man. It's never too late, is it? Never too late to start doing something for God. What an encouragement that should be to every one of us in this room today. Abraham was 75 years of age when he decided he was going to walk with God. Moses was 80 when God called him from being a pastor of a flock in the backside of the desert to become one of the greatest men who have ever changed the destinies of this poor old world in which we live. And I can see some of you saying, oh yes, well that's just Bible people. They lived a long time in those days. But let me remind you of the story of George Muller of Bristol. When George Muller of Bristol was 70 years of age, he already had left behind him some mighty monuments to a life spent gloriously for God. 5 large orphan houses stood on Ashley Down in Bristol as monuments to God. Over 10,000 orphans had been housed and fed and clothed and settled in gainful employment to the glory of God. Professor Randall Short, one of the great leading surgeons of Bristol, said that his father used to tell him that in the days of George Muller, agnosticism did not dare to rear its head in Bristol. Day schools and Sunday schools in many lands had benefited from the munificence of George Muller. 2 million Bibles and Bible portions had been circulated through his efforts. 3 million books and tracts. A poor man dependent solely upon God, George Muller, one way or another, received and gave away the astonishing sum of something like $7.5 million, which in terms of today's inflated currency could be multiplied at least by 10. When George Muller was 70, he decided the time had come for a change. 5 times during the first 8 years after his conversion, George Muller decided that he ought to be a missionary, and he offered himself to this mission board and to that, and was always turned down. One wonders at the mentality of a mission board which would turn down a candidate of the caliber of George Muller. But they did. But when he was 70, he decided that now he would become a missionary. And the world became his parish. He began to follow the leading of the Cloudy Pillar, and he traveled throughout the United Kingdom and the continent of Europe, across the Atlantic Ocean, the length and breadth of the United States of America, on to the mainland of Asia, and on down to the subcontinent of Australia. Look at him! Look at this old man, will you, if you please? He's an old man, 70, 80 years of age. He travels 200,000 miles. Long before aircraft became a thing to be reckoned with. Speaking over 6,000 times in spite of advancing years, and he died at the ripe old age of 93. Dr. Arthur T. Pearson estimates that he preached steadily over 70 years and delivered approximately 10,000 messages. Here was a fire, here was a man, here was a bush, that burned with the fires of God and was not consumed. When Caleb was 85, he goes to Joshua and he says, I want you to give me this mountain. I haven't yet begun to fight. What a grand old man. Oh, I pray that older people in this meeting this evening will come back to this text in Joshua chapter 14 and take Caleb as their shining example. Now, you know, if it's never too late to do something for God, it's never too soon to start. For Caleb laid the foundations of his tremendous finish in the way that he lived his life through all the hectic rush and bustle and pressure of life's working years. The total dedication that characterized the working years of his life. Let me say again, it's never too late for you to start something for God. But it's never too soon to begin. And young people, let me say this to you. You can't start soon enough. Dear old friend of mine, who for many years was the pastor, the radio pastor of Moody Bible Institute, the position that our friend Don Cole now fills. Dear old Mr. Little, when he was in his 70s, his early 70s, he was speaking at a meeting like this, and a man of about 50 years of age came up to him and said, "Mr. Little, I wish I had your knowledge of the Bible." R.J. looked at this man. He said, "Sir," he said, "let me tell you, you're too late. You're 40 years too late. You'll never have my knowledge of the Bible. If you're going to get anything done for God, start while you're young." At the age of 85, Caleb could look back over the years when life was at its busiest and at its prime, and he could say, "I have wholly followed the Lord." In other words, Caleb could testify that he had followed the Lord fully. He was born just about the time that Moses fled from Egypt to take up shepherding in the backside of the desert. He was born in slavery, under the sentence of death. Often in his early youth, during the teenage years of his life, he had groaned under the taskmaster's lash. Often he had longed for a savior, one who would come and redeem him and set him free. And then one day Moses had come, the kinsman redeemer, and Caleb had seen the Passover lamb slain for him. He had experienced redemption through the precious blood. He crossed over the Red Sea, and he took his place with the tribe of Judah gathered around the Lord's table in the wilderness. Under the blood, through the water, around the table. He had drunk water from the riven rock. He had smitten Amalek with the edge of the sword. He had been to Sinai and learned how God expects a believer to order his life. He had done something few people had ever done in his day. He crossed over Jordan and learned what it was like to live in the land of promise. He had seen cities great and walled up to heaven. He had seen giants stalking through the land. He had seen the sons of the Anakim there. He had estimated the strength of the enemy. The world, the flesh, the devil. And he wholly followed the Lord. Where others could only see giants, Caleb could only see God. Where others looked at the problems, Caleb looked at the promises. Where others saw a dangerous, dreadful, diabolical foe, Caleb could only see a defeated foe. Where others faltered and failed, Caleb followed. And Caleb determined in those days that he would wholly follow the Lord. In his life there would be no rivals, there would be no refusals, and there would be no retreat. And he wholly followed the Lord. He followed the Lord fully. But you know, he also followed the Lord faithfully. I can't imagine why any Hebrew father would call his son what Caleb's father called him. He called him Caleb. And in case you don't know what that means, it means dog. How would you like to be called dog? Dog cold. Rather reminds me of the fellow who went to a psychiatrist. He said, you know, I've got this terrible feeling that I'm a dog. The psychiatrist said, how long has this been going on? He said, ever since I was a puppy. Well, you know, Caleb's name meant dog, if you please. It was an unusually objectionable and obnoxious name amongst the Hebrew people. They looked upon the dog as an unclean animal. Well, I can't understand why his father called him dog. He must have had ulcers or something. But you know, there's something about a dog. I suppose Caleb decided if he was going to be a dog, if he was going to be known as Caleb, then he was going to be a good one. He was going to be faithful. There's nothing really can substitute for a good, faithful dog. I remember some years ago when my son was about 6 or 7 years of age, he came home and announced to his mother that he wanted a dog. The dog he wanted was a young little puppy, a cocker spaniel, $50. His mother, not wanting a dog in the house, having a couple of teenage kids and him, figured she had enough problems. She thought she would deal with the situation adequately. She says, you can have a dog when you can afford one. $50 indeed. Well, the kid went out and got himself a job making flea collars. My father said he didn't know fleas wore collars. Well, he got this job making flea collars, and within 2 weeks, the enterprising young man came home with his dog. Much to his mother's disgust. But I'll tell you something about that dog. That was the most intelligent dog I ever met. My son paid for him. My wife had to clean up after him. My daughters took him out for his daily constitutional, and that dog was crazy over me. And I remember time and time again when I'd come home from being away, and sometimes it was late and the family were all in bed, that dog would be there, and he'd be waiting, and he'd give me a warm, warm welcome home. Sometimes the only welcome home I ever got. You know, Mark Twain on one occasion saw a townsman of his tying a rope around a dog's neck and preparing to throw him into the river. He asked the fellow why he was drowning his dog. Oh, he said, that dog's no good. He won't come to heel. He just chases after any man or any boy who whistles to him. I've got no use for a dog like that. And apparently neither had Mark Twain. He stood by and watched him drown. Caleb decided that if he was going to be a dog, if he was going to be called Caleb, then he was going to be faithful. And he was going to stay like a faithful hound at the master's heels. And looking back over his life at the age of 85, he could say, yes, and I've done it. I have wholly followed the Lord. He followed the Lord fully and faithfully. Never took his eyes off the master's face. Only a word from the master, and Caleb was the way to do his bidding. He could say, I have wholly followed the Lord, not once, not twice, not usually, but always, always. There was no swerving aside. There were no spurts and no stops. Absolute steadiness. Some years ago, an English friend of mine was traveling across the Atlantic in what was then the world's largest liner, the Queen Elizabeth. Presently, a smudge of smoke appeared on the horizon behind them, and presently it resolved itself into the SS United States. The world's largest liner, if you please, I regret to have to tell you, was being overtaken by the world's fastest liner. As the SS United States crept up alongside and gradually began to pull ahead of the Queen Elizabeth, the skipper on board the SS United States sent a message by radio across to the skipper of the SS Queen Elizabeth. You are very beautiful, but you are very slow. The captain of the Queen Elizabeth was ready. He sent back an answer. He said, it is not meet for the royal lady to keep fast company. Now, my friend happened to know the chief engineer aboard the SS Elizabeth. He was a Christian. And one day, the chief engineer invited Alan Redpath to go down and see the engines. Way down they went to the boiler room where there were four great steam boilers. Four of them had not been in use since the Second World War. One of them, they just used that extra boiler during the war to help race the Queen across the Atlantic in defiance of all of Hitler's U-boats. After inspecting the boilers, they went down to the very bowels of the boat, down to the very bottom of the ship. And there they saw two enormous propeller shafts, 450 feet long, 150 yards of solid steel, going round and round at an enormous speed. They went back to where the propeller shafts went out to the blades, and they could hear the thrash of four giant propellers driving that mighty hotel across the Atlantic, all 82,000 tons of it. Later, back in the chief engineer's cabin, my friend ventured a comment. He said, I suppose those propellers must be going around at a tremendous speed. Chief engineer looked at him. He said, it's obvious, Alan, that you are not an engineer. Do you know, he said, I could get those propellers going so fast, they would simply make a hole in the water and the ship would slow down and ultimately come to a complete stop. Do you know, he said, I've got 48 engineers on this ship, and they are continually calculating the ratio between revolutions per minute in the engine room and steadiness at the point of drive. Did you get it? The ratio between revolutions per minute in the engine room and steadiness at the point of drive. That's what God wants from you and from me. He wants steadiness at the point of drive. Caleb could say, I have not only followed the Lord fully, I have followed the Lord faithfully. Steadiness at the point of drive. Also, he followed the Lord fearlessly. He said, give me this mountain. He said, I know all about this mountain. The sons of the Anakim are there. I know that the cities are great and fenced. If so be, the Lord will be with me. He says, we'll be able to drive them out. Give me this mountain. He followed the Lord fearlessly. Notice, first you notice his clear assessment of the outlook. Caleb was no starry-eyed visionary. He didn't think that a life of victory was something easy. He didn't expect to be carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease. He didn't expect that all he had to do was have some kind of mysterious ascetic experience that would waft you up onto some mystical cloud nine and there you'd live a rosy, mythical, unreal spiritual experience. Oh, look, he says, I realize it's going to be an uphill fight all the way. It's a mountain. He realized that a life of victory was going to be arduous. He knew that the Anakim were there, a race of giants. He knew that a life of victory was going to be dangerous. He knew that the cities were great and fenced, and they would only be taken by long and stubborn siege. He knew it was going to be tedious. His clear assessment of the outlook. A life of victory. Going all out for God. No rivals. No refusals. No retreat.
A life that was going to be arduous and dangerous and tedious.
But oh, look. Notice his calm assurance of the outlook. He says, if so be the Lord will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. You notice he didn't underestimate the foe, but mark you, neither did he overestimate himself. His plan of waging war and entering into a life of victorious living for God and taking new territories in the name of the living God and moving forward God's cause upon this earth. As far as Caleb was concerned, he was going to do it trusting in the presence of God and in the promise of God. He said, if so be, the Lord will be with me. There's the presence of God, as the Lord hath said. There's the promise of God. And you know, the only way that anybody in any age can live a life of victory over the enemies which are set against us and arrayed against us on every hand is in the confidence of the Lord's presence. And of his promise. But you know, you come back another step in the life of Caleb to that true decision that characterized the waking years of his life. When he was a comparatively young man, Caleb made up his mind that he was going to live for God no matter what the cost. No matter what anybody else did. No matter what his brethren did. No matter what people around him did, he was going to live for God. And he was going to go where God sent him. And he was going to do what God wanted him to do. When Caleb and Joshua and the 10 others went to spy out of the land, they came back with sample of the fruit that could be theirs in Canaan. And you know, the ten could report on were the awful, terrible, unspeakable battles that awaited them in Canaan. But oh, Caleb, he said, never mind the battles, think of the blessings. Oh, the blessings that await us in Canaan. And Caleb made the great decision of his life, where others could only be occupied with the foes in Canaan. Caleb occupied himself with the fruits that were in Canaan. And there and then, along with Joshua, another young man, he turned in a minority report of two. And he decreed and declared that he would believe God. He said, the God who brought us out can bring us in. And I who have trusted God to bring me out, I can trust God also to bring me into the place of victory and fruitfulness. You know, it almost cost him his life. The land, he said, is an exceeding good land. If the Lord delight in us, then he will bring us in. Rebel not against the Lord, neither fear ye the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is departed from them. The Lord is with us, fear them not. And all the congregation, we read, bade stone them with stones. Oh, my young brother, my young sister, are you going to cast in your lot with God? You've come to these meetings, you've heard the messages. Many, many times God has spoken to you. Why don't you give it back to him, that life of yours? Why don't you determine like Caleb, well, as far as I'm concerned, I'm going to wholly follow the Lord. I don't care about anybody else. I'm going to follow the Lord. Are you prepared, young person, to follow the Lord in the matter of your life partner? Are you prepared to follow the Lord in the matter of your life profession? Are you prepared to follow the Lord in the matter of your life priorities? Caleb was. And when he was 85, he could look back and say, I don't regret a minute of it. I have wholly followed the Lord. Soldiers, said Garibaldi as he marched out to liberate Italy, soldiers, he said, what I offer you is fatigue, danger, struggle, and death. The chill of the cold night air.
the burning heat beneath the blazing sun. No lodgings, no munitions, no provisions. But forced marches, perilous watch posts, and the continual struggle with the bayonet against strong batteries. Those who love freedom and their country may follow me.
Come, says the Lord Jesus, come.
Take up your cross and follow me.
Would you say to him this evening, yes, Lord, I come.